from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, 20 years ago this month, the historic trade accord between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, went into effect. And two decades later, we'll consider the successes and failures of the trade agreement and how it has changed conditions for the three countries involved, as well as its future and the future of similar trade agreements. Join us for Forum. That's up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this morning's opening Forum Hour, we assess NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which came into force on New Year's Day 20 years ago. Begun in the Reagan administration, negotiated during the first George Bush administration, and legislated via bipartisan support during the Clinton administration, the agreement involved three signatories, the United States, Mexico, and Canada. It created the world's largest free trade area, a common market for goods, services, and investment capital between the three nations, and it served as a model for the World Trade Organization, bilateral trade treaties, and the deal which opened markets to China. It was, and it remains 20 years later, a source of great controversy, and in this first Forum Hour, we assess its successes and its failures and look ahead to its future, as well as the future of similar proposed trade deals. We have a couple of guests here with us for the hour. Joining us from the nation's capital, Ambassador Carla Hills is actually former U.S. Trade Representative between 1989 and 1993, who was a primary negotiator for the United States on NAFTA, presently co-chairs the Council on Foreign Relations, and is chair and CEO of Hills & Company International Consultants. Welcome, Ambassador Carla Hills.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Lori Wallach, who is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group that monitors groups like the World Trade Organization and agreements like NAFTA. And welcome, Lori Wallach.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have both of you aboard. And let me begin, Ambassador Hills, if I may, with you. I read with some interest your piece in Foreign Affairs in the January-February issue of Foreign Affairs called NAFTA's Economic Upsides. And essentially, you argue that this has been a great success, united the economies, created a $19 trillion regional market, and brought about economic, political, and social integration in North America. That all sounds very good.
That's my point of view, and I think the statistics show that just exactly that. Today, when we talk about economic growth and jobs, we talk about trade because that is one of the pillars of our growth. And today, Canada is America's single largest export market, and Mexico is our second single largest export market. Canada is responsible for some 8 million U.S. jobs in connection with their trade, and Mexico is responsible for 6 million U.S. jobs. So it has been a positive agreement. I think we can build on it. The world has moved forward. Nothing is static, but it did become a template for trade agreements that the United States subsequently negotiated.
As you also point out in your article, though, a lot of the criticism, actually a lot of those who you say attack it on economic grounds, focus on Mexico rather than Canada and say that that partnership is one-sided or that Mexico's gain is America's pain. To some degree, that argument seems to follow by many people's lights, largely because of migration northward, job outsourcing, loss of jobs, especially in the agricultural sector in Mexico. In fact, all of these are often highlighted. And you say what to those kinds of criticisms?
Well, actually, the migration northward has stopped, and some of our sectors are complaining about that. But let's look at the facts. Last year, 14% of our nation's total exports went to Mexico. That exceeds our sales to Brazil, Russia, India, and China combined. Indeed, Mexico buys more from us than all the rest of Latin America combined, and more than Germany, France, Great Britain, and Netherlands combined. Mexico's trade with the United States increased by over 500% between 1993 and 2012, and that compares with about 275% with the rest of the world. And in other words, almost double that with the rest of the world. So I think that Mexico should not be frowned upon. We should find ways where we could work more closely together, and there are lots of things we can do, both in terms of trade agreements, facilitating trade across border through infrastructure, and a host of other measures.
Well, we'll be hearing in the course of this hour from two Mexican nationals, both pro and con, where NAFTA is concerned. But what, before I get on to some other things with you, Ambassador Hills, I just wondered about the argument that Mexico is the only Latin American country where poverty is growing in recent years.
That poverty has come down.
That actually, no, that it's grown in recent years, at least according to the statistics I've been reading.
That you're saying that it's slowing? Their poverty rate.
I'm sorry. Let me. We seem to have a problem. That poverty has grown in Mexico more than other Latin American countries. Grown.
I don't think you can say that that is a result of the North American Free Trade Agreement. In fact, the middle class has grown, according to my statistics, in Mexico. And I wouldn't give all the credit to the NAFTA for that positive outcome either. The fact of the matter is that the government has instituted a number of social programs that have contributed to middle-class growth. There's a lot more that can be done, as President Peña has pointed out. Mexico desperately needs to move forward on its economic reform.
What about the argument also that you often hear, and I guess it boils down to globalization and how people see globalization. It's a multidimensional question, of course, but that something like NAFTA and other trade agreements that we'll talk about in the course of this hour that are modeled after NAFTA, they do more for investors than they do particularly for environmental protection.
The environmental protection was a side letter to the NAFTA agreement, and I think we can do more in terms of the environment by reducing trade restrictions on what I call green products and green technology. But I truly believe that in this globalized world in which we live, to have closed markets is to diminish opportunity. Actually, the United States has roughly 5% of the world's population, and it produces roughly 20% of its output. And we need to find markets for our products. And we need to be more competitive, more productive, and we do that, and has certainly done that, in the North American region. Keep in mind, the North American region now is highly interrelated. That we don't not only make things together, we not only sell things, we make things together. 25 cents of every dollar that we import from Canada is U.S. content, and 40 cents of every dollar that we import from Mexico is U.S. content. By comparison with Japan, it's 2 cents. So we really have a win-win situation in North America with our two neighbors.
Again, Ambassador Carla Hills with us from Washington, D.C., was primary negotiator for the United States on NAFTA and is presently chair and CEO of Hills & Company. And Lori Wallach is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch and is opposed to NAFTA and was opposed from the beginning. In fact, I think I read a piece where you said you cried when NAFTA went into effect. But let's go right to the present, if we could, with you, Lori Wallach. Maybe we could find out what brought tears, because there was a lot of hype on both sides, as I recall, because we certainly had a lot of debate in those days. But the position that we're hearing from Ambassador Hills is one of fueling unprecedented trade, creating millions of jobs, and integrating economic, political, and social factors in North America.
Well, her view is one that is not shared, the polling shows, by Democrats, independents, or Republicans when asked how they feel about NAFTA and the United States. The majority say we should get out of it, actually, and that they oppose it. But I understand why the public feels that way. Instead of, in any year of NAFTA creating the 200,000 jobs per year that President Clinton promised to sell it, we've seen net 1 million U.S. jobs lost to unbalanced trade with Mexico and Canada since NAFTA. And the gist of what happened is before NAFTA, we had a small trade surplus with Mexico, about $3 billion in 1993, a not huge trade deficit in the 20s of billions of dollars with Canada. by the last year's data, 2012, we had a combined $185 billion new NAFTA trade deficit. So if you use the official U.S. government methodology for calculating how trade flows affect employment, it's a net loss of more than 1 million jobs. But more importantly, NAFTA fundamentally changed the patterns of investment and trade such that since NAFTA, U.S. exports are actually growing more slowly by half than before NAFTA, and our trade deficit with Mexico and Canada is increasing at 45% more than before NAFTA. And a big part of that are the very rules you mentioned about investment. NAFTA had investor protections that instead of having goods made here and sold there, more exports, promoted the export of investment and jobs, promoted, incentivized offshoring.
I'm wondering, as I look at figures, how to sort this out, because the real questions come down to what successes NAFTA has had versus the failures. And obviously you and Ambassador Hills have completely opposed positions there. But trade increases, about 3.5 increase since the 1994 levels, even faster in terms of increase over in Asia, and particularly with China. But the Congressional Research Service says overall NAFTA, modest effect. So maybe part of the problem, you know, as I was kind of piecing this together, was that both sides were talking about, inflated expectations, certainly on the pro side, and terrible damage and catastrophe on the negative side.
Well, let me take both of those items one by one. As far as the volume of trade is not the measurement that affects people. The question is, what does it mean for our jobs, our wages, et cetera?
So in other words, excuse me, GDP would not be necessarily your criterion here.
Well, no. You just talked
about... No, I was talking about trade, but I would add GDP to that as well.
Well, I separate GDP. One of the measurements of GDP, a subtractor from growth, is a deficit in trade. When you have a current account deficit, that's a minus for GDP. So what happened with NAFTA is the volume of trade grew, but mainly it was imports. So it's a little bit like saying that when you have a horrible full moon high tide with a storm surge, having more volume is always a good thing, but we know it's not. 480% of that increase is on the import side. Our trade deficit increased 480%. So having more volume is not good unless it's balanced. If we had had a lot more exports and a balanced trade with Mexico and Canada, having more volume could have been good. The problem is what, and this gets to the second point, which is the effect. The transformational effect of NAFTA was in altering the composition of those jobs available and the wage levels available to the 63% of Americans who do not have a college degree. We have seen in the 20 years since NAFTA and also China entering the World Trade Organization a fundamental transformation of the replacement of higher wage benefits paying manufacturing jobs available for those without a college degree who are the vast majority of us being replaced by lower wage service sector jobs. For instance, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does a study that gauges how much in wages one loses or gains when you go from one sector to another. So in their most recent study, which is the data for 2012, a manufacturing worker who was displaced by trade lost wages on average more than 20% of their total wages. That downward pressure across the economy is a major contributor to income inequality. And that, by the way, is a point that economists who support NAFTA and who oppose NAFTA all agree. For instance, the Institute for International Economics did a study, and they attributed about 39% of the increase in income inequality to pressures caused by trade. The offshoring of higher wage jobs and then people getting lower wage jobs in non-offshorable sectors like retail and hospitality and healthcare. The threat of relocation of jobs used to bust unions and undermine negotiations. There are several very famous studies, one done by Cornell University, tracking that effect under NAFTA. And then also all those manufacturing workers who are now in the labor market with all the folks who were in the service sector are now bringing down wages as they're hunting for a new job to replace their trade offshore manufacturing job. So even in those sectors where the number of jobs are growing, like hospitality, retail, et cetera, wages actually are flat. So, for instance, worker productivity in the U.S. has tripled since NAFTA, but real wages in inflation-controlled terms have increased not even 1% a year.
Let me go back to Ambassador Hills on this. I'd like to get, Carla Hills, your response to this wage inequality and outsourcing. NAFTA, actually, according to a report in Public Citizen, has had a negative impact on the U.S. workforce because of, well, also rising imports as well as offshore production. So they argue.
Oh. First of all, I would say that it is not correct that the service sector pays much lower than the overall sector. In fact, the Peterson Institute that Ms. Wallach cites show that the data for jobs on service sector pays more. Secondly, although she is contending that NAFTA has depressed wages, Yale University and the Federal Reserve has concluded a study that shows that when adjusted for inflation, actually wages in all three countries have risen in the NAFTA countries. But I find some of the data that is being thrown about quite incorrect, and there's no question that we would be worse off if the markets to our north and the markets to our south had not been opened up. It is a fact that we have become one of the most competitive regions in the world. That does not mean the rest of the world has stood still. It means that we have to pick up and build on the NAFTA platform. And you cannot complain about the fact that our neighbors are using our products in their exports. In fact, another benefit of Mexico's exports to the rest of the world is it spends 50 cents of every dollar it earns from its exports to the rest of the world on U.S. product. So the economic relationship is very positive. I do think we could make it stronger.
But there's an argument, I guess, Lori Wallach, that and I will come back to sort of the essence of, I think, what you were saying here, that when I extrapolate your argument, it says that workers have been hurt, that perhaps we could frame it this way, that NAFTA has helped corporations but not workers and maybe freed the multinationals too much from regulation.
Well, that's not what the Yale University Federal Reserve study shows at all, and they say
that question was directed at me.
Have gone up. The other factor that Ms. Wallach talks about is a growing deficit. If you take energy out of our sales to our north, Canada, to our south, Mexico, we have a surplus. We have a better profile with those two countries than with any countries in the rest of the world.
I did direct a question to Lori Wallach, but Lori Wallach, you want to respond to what Ambassador Hills just said as well?
Well, first of all, it's just factually wrong. I mean, for instance, since NAFTA, the share of our trade with Mexico and Canada that's oil has decreased almost 30%. So actually, if you take out oil, we still have a trade deficit. They're sending in the products that used to be made here from Mexico, where the jobs were offshored. If you look at our website, which is tradewatch.org, through a Freedom of Information Act request, we have the entire trade adjustment assistance database. It reads like the funeral program of the middle class. All these big U.S. transnational companies that promised, if NAFTA passed, they promised Congress they'd create jobs here, GE, Chrysler, etc. We have them, Caterpillar. We have a whole study listing all of their promises with footnotes, the original things they said in 93. Those guys are certified as having fired their U.S. workers and relocating production to the much lower wages of Mexico. And so this trade adjustment assistance database is almost 900,000 specific U.S. casualties of NAFTA listed. Well, you can search on our database at tradewatch.org by your zip code, by the name of the company, et cetera, and see the lived experience. But I want to get back to your bigger question, which is, you phrased it exactly right. It's been a loser for most people and probably for some of the big companies that could take advantage of it. It's been a big boost in profits. But the data I'm citing is the Mexican government data. In our report, which has 180 footnotes to the original government sources, the Mexican government's official data show poverty has increased in Mexico since NAFTA.
Actually, I'd like
to... income inequality has increased in Mexico since NAFTA.
I'd like to take that statistic that you just brought up and segue to Manuel Suarez Mira, who is also with us. And we're going to hear, as I said, from two Mexican nationals, one pro and one anti-NAFTA. Manuel Suarez Mira is pro-NAFTA. He directs the American University Center for North American Studies, and the center recently commissioned a national public opinion poll in Canada, Mexico, and the United States to measure public attitudes on relations between the three countries. Welcome, Manuel Suarez Mira, and good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be there. And it reminds me of 25 years ago, in which Laurie and I were having basically the same arguments on each side.
Well, let's bring them up to date, first of all. I mean, one argument you might have is over national opposition, which Laurie Wallach cited here in the United States to NAFTA. You took a poll in Mexico, and what was the outcome of that poll?
No, actually, the study that we did was in the three countries, and the results were remarkably even in the three countries, with overwhelming support for closer integration of North America. So the peoples of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. are all in a majority in favor of closer integration in North America.
And what about for Mexican workers? And what about the fact that we have more billionaires in Mexico now? We have Carlos Slim and all that, but some are arguing that the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer in Mexico.
No, that's not true. That's a distortion of facts. In fact, you have far less poor today than we had 25 years ago. What has happened? You have to distinguish between income distribution and poverty. The income distribution has not improved. It improved initially, but then it worsened. But the number of poor has diminished, and the number of middle-class people has grown enormously. So those two things, income distribution and poverty alleviation, are completely separate and should be distinguished separately.
You read the arguments, though, that Mexico's rural industries have been destabilized, that there's been loss of manufacturing and shipping jobs, less production oversight. In other words, displacement of many Mexicans to the point where it's, even though we've been through a recession and there's been a thinning out of those coming here to find refuge in the United States, there's been a heightening of migration and a heightening of outsourcing. So the argument goes.
That's, again, wrong. The net number of migrants today from Mexico to the U.S. is zero. You have more people going back, or rather the same people going back that are coming in, number one. Number two, you cannot attribute all of these economic phenomena on NAFTA alone. The problem in Mexico was that we had a reform agenda that was not carried out after NAFTA. NAFTA was the one initial movement that should have been supported by all sorts of economic, structural, and institutional reforms.
And again, Manuel Suarez Mira is with us from Washington. He directs the American University Center for North American Studies. It's good to have you, Manuel Suarez Mira, and I thank you for being with us. I want to also give the phone number for listeners so that you can join us. If you'd like to put your 2 cents in here or join the conversation, you can do so by going to our toll-free number. That's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. More when we return. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our subject for discussion this hour is NAFTA 20 years ago, after the pact was, made into law and the historic trade accord between the United States, Mexico, and Canada went into effect. Two decades later, it is still important, I think, not only consider successes and failures of the trade agreement and how it has changed conditions for the three countries involved, but also to look toward the future. I mean, we've got also on tap here other trade agreements, and we'll talk about that in the course of the hour. Ambassador Carla Hills is with us. She is presently chair and CEO of Hills & Company and co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations. Hills & Company is an international consultant. She was a primary negotiator for the United States with NAFTA and a U.S. trade representative between 1989 and 1993. And Lori Wallach directs Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, a nonpartisan, nonprofit group that monitors groups like the World Trade Organization and also agreements like NAFTA, and has put out a report on NAFTA. We also spoke earlier with, toward the end of that first segment, with Manuel Suarez Mir, who directs American University Center for North American Studies. We thought we'd have voices from Mexican nationals pro and con, and we'll speak later on in the hour with Manuel Perez Oroca, who is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and who is opposed to NAFTA. We should mention also that American University put out a report under Robert Pastor's name, which said that NAFTA was responsible for the greatest influx of growth and jobs in the United States after the pact had been installed. But as you can hear from the arguments going back and forth here, there has been disagreement on both sides with the facts and with how to interpret the facts or what the facts actually are. There was a lot of rhetoric, many of you may remember, about the benefits, about NAFTA closing the U.S.-Mexico wage gap when it was first being promoted, boosting job growth, fighting poverty, protecting the environment. And those opposed said millions of jobs would move south. And remember that big sucking song of sound of Ross Perot, and labor and farm groups were predicting mass exodus from the Mexican countryside. This is 20 years later, and we're really trying to get the pulse of sorting it all out here. I wondered, Lori Wallach, if you could talk about one of the benefits that we hear about NAFTA is that it has had particular benefit to border towns. I wonder what your response is to that. These border communities, one hears the argument that they were tremendously enhanced, that they become hotbeds because of NAFTA, boom towns, really. I'm talking about El Paso and Laredo, that they've been enhanced enormously. On the other side is, there's still all kinds of problems with sewage, with air quality, with all kinds of spent level acid car batteries being exported north, about 500% up, and only limited environmental provisions is also the argument. So help us sort it out from your perspective, then we'll hear from Ambassador Hills.
Well, one of the things that's the most startling in the data of all the NAFTA job loss is how many jobs were lost in those border towns in Mexico in manufacturing. So the boomtown effect has been in transport, getting the goods that are being made in Mexico now instead of the U.S. shipped across the border and sent for distribution for retail in the U.S. And there's been a boom in certain services relating to customs and all of the increasing imports from Mexico. But as far as actual employment in those cities, El Paso is one of the cities that has been the hardest hit as far as real people losing lots of manufacturing jobs. As well, on the Mexican side of the border, the big issue is the air pollution being caused by these huge backups, miles and miles for hours and hours, of semis packed with goods, a lot of them U.S. brands, but made in Mexico, being shipped across the border for sale in the U.S., things that used to be made here. So there are a lot of very serious environmental health problems with these trucks that stand there idling hour after hour. And that contributed to what already were very severe environmental problems on the border that NAFTA was, you know, claimed to fix. It hasn't fixed them. And in fact, now, 20 years after NAFTA, there have been some $360 million paid out actually to corporations who've attacked environmental health laws, water laws, land use laws, zoning laws under the NAFTA investor state tribunal system, which lets foreign companies attack domestic laws and order payment from the U.S., Mexican, or Canadian Treasury for environmental and other policies the companies don't like.
Yeah, I'm looking at a listener remark on our website. It says the environment being excluded from international trade agreements, including NAFTA in the U.S. Every textile factory must clean its water output to be as clean as before it entered. Production in China and Mexico, where wastewater is dumped into the rivers and oceans, equals an immediate cost savings and lower priced products in stores. It is killing jobs here and the earth. When, if ever, will the United States integrate the environment into its international trade laws, if ever? Well, hope we can take that up. But let me go first to you, Ambassador Hills. On the border towns, get a response, please.
I think you have to be very, very careful about attributing everything that goes wrong to the NAFTA. We've been through a very deep recession, and the data shows that the NAFTA increased the jobs up until the recession started. Keep in mind that today we have supply chains encircling the globe. Specialization has become important to our competitiveness. And about half our trade with Canada and Mexico takes place between related companies, resulting in specialization, which has boosted productivity in all three economies. And I would say also, with respect to the jobs, where I have a debate with Ms. Wallach, that Mexico offers significant opportunity to our entrepreneurs, whether they be large or small. And this, but it's the smaller entrepreneurs that particularly benefit from Mexico's proximity and openness to trade. Mexico purchases about 11% of the export from our small and medium-sized businesses, and it is those businesses that create half the jobs in the United States. So we want them to have open markets in which they can participate, and certainly Canada and Mexico have served that purpose very, very well.
Here's a guest, Keith, who emails us and says, the key factor that shifts jobs offshore, you should tell Lori Wallach, is not NAFTA, but containerization and the ability to ship goods cheaply per unit over long distance from ports to call with better wage production ratios. And we asked our listeners on Facebook to tell us what they think of NAFTA 20 years later. Let me just read some of these responses, and we'll go to your calls. And you can join us, by the way, on phone at 866-733-6786. Noah writes, almost instant gratification for the consumer, but very short-sighted in the long run. Ralph says, the economists told us these agreements and free trade is good for both countries. They're right, but they forgot to tell us the benefits tend to accrue to the 0.1%. Oscar writes, good for the USA, not so good for other countries. And Barbie writes, no one is looking for benefit to benefit the masses with these agreements. These agreements are designed to benefit a few. So many mom-and-pop businesses in Mexico had to close down after Walmart introduced their stores on the other side of the border. Our own economy is on the decline, along with thousands of jobs vanishing during these 20 years. Thanks to NAFTA, it is irresponsible. Whole range of opinions. Let's hear from some of you by phone. First caller, Francesco, good morning.
Hi. When first NAFTA was drafted, they were talking about the wage difference. You know, Mexicans getting $2 an hour and we getting $20 an hour. And we see the results now. We are laying off teachers. We are closing the schools. Nobody can afford colleges. And that was the plan to get the NAFTA working, get the American workers to get paid the same as Mexicans. And we see even in our public markets, you see all sorts of Mexican fruit laced with chemicals that are banned in this country. Any way you look at it, NAFTA is a big problem for American regular people. What do you think about that?
Well, we'll go to Ambassador Hills again, if you would. Carla Hills.
I did not get the point of the gentleman's question.
The question is that to make the American workers get paid the same as Mexican, we need to close the schools, and that's what we are doing. We are laying off teachers. We have a $6 trillion war going on, but we don't have money for teachers. That's the plan, to close the universities, close the schools, and make the workers get paid the same as Mexican.
The challenge of improving our educational system is a real challenge. The challenge of expanding opportunities for workers and small businesses is a separate challenge. We need the resources that come from growth and productivity and jobs to be able to address the challenges of education, of environment, of growth in opportunities for young people. And you can't blame what is going on in other sectors on trade. Trade is not a magic wand. It creates opportunity, and it generates growth.
I think we
and NAFTA has done both.
I think we could concede that NAFTA has been sort of a scapegoat or a whipping boy for all kinds of economic problems. But nevertheless, we're hearing Lori Wallach's point of view, which is certainly critical in NAFTA. I wanted to bring in another point of view from a Mexican national, and that's Manuel Perez Rocha, who is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, and he grew up in Mexico. And welcome to the program, Manuel Perez Rocha. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you left Mexico when, if I may?
Excuse me?
When did you leave Mexico as a...
About 7 years ago, I came to the U.S. My wife is American. My kids were born here, so...
So you lived through 13 years of NAFTA in Mexico and now have been in the United States 7 years. I just wanted to kind of get that on the record because you're opposed to NAFTA and opposed to the effect it's had on the Mexican economy. Why?
Because it has had a very strong impact on the Mexican economy. Mexico has been one of the countries in Latin America that has had the most sluggish rate of growth during the last 20 years. Per capita growth in Mexico has been of 0.87% in average during the NAFTA era. That has produced a lot of joblessness in Mexico. I mean, there is a lot of underemployment in Mexico. About 50% of people in Mexico are underemployed, and the rate of poverty hasn't diminished. 53% of people are still living in poverty in Mexico. So NAFTA hasn't really created what it was supposed to do, which was more jobs and better employment conditions for Mexicans. And on the contrary, the free trade agreement is still being used to attract investment in Mexico, given the Mexico's competitive advantage, which is no other than very low salaries. No.
Well, there was also a good deal of concern when NAFTA went into effect about the maquiladoras and worker wages. Those have been flat, and you're saying, in effect, that across the board, worker wages and employment has not been helped by NAFTA.
No, during the NAFTA, minimum wages in Mexico have lost about 18% of their purchasing power. And this has reached, well, a total loss of 76% for the whole neoliberal period. I mean, when we talk about neoliberalism in Mexico, we're talking about 30 years. But during NAFTA, there are calculations that each worker has been dispossessed of around $88,000, which is equivalent to 4 years of the person's salary. And the wage gap between Mexico and the United States has remained basically the same. So the conditions for workers in Mexico have not improved.
And I'm looking at an email here from a listener. Actually, it's a website posting. I wonder if you would respond to it. He writes, NAFTA, while in rich Wall Street and multinational corporations, did lots of damage to the U.S. economy and ruined the Mexican economy. It totally destroyed the small farms owned by Mexican families, as well as small factories in Mexico that were owned by Mexican people. NAFTA has led to extreme poverty in Mexico that led to the out-of-control drug violence and the floods of Mexican immigrants to the United States and loss of life to many of them. Now, those are quite an array, a catalog of charges. And as I said, there's an attempt to some degree to maybe scapegoat NAFTA and make it culpable for so many things that are beyond reason. But you would say what to those charges?
Well, you know, NAFTA is not to blame for every piece of malice that Mexico is under. But NAFTA is part of a larger economic strategy that we call it neoliberalism, which includes the privatization of state companies. Mexico just privatized it's in the process of privatizing its energy sector. A bill that allows investments from large transnationals into the oil sector in Mexico has just been passed. So NAFTA is part of a larger machinery, which is the economy of deregulation, the economy of privatization, and the economy of disenfranchising lower social classes and workers.
But let me just read you another web comment and get your a quick response to you from it, because I want to go to more of our callers, too. This is Robert, who writes, "World trade and the mobility of operations to other nations have had a negative impact on manufacturing operations in the U.S. The simple fact is that without NAFTA and related agreements, the decisions to move these operations offshore would have been more precipitous, not less. I'm a manufacturing engineer with a lot of experience directing operations in places as diverse as Guadalajara and Monterrey, Mexico, Penang, Malaysia, and Shanghai, China, to name a few. There is utterly no question that the NAFTA agreement has increased the total commerce between these regions. The advancement and improvement of operations in Mexico has had its greatest effect within my industry in moving operations from Asia back to North America. Operations added in Mexico have in turn enhanced activity in the United States. I've seen this in my industry, and colleagues in related industries have seen it. It's a fact."
Well, what is exactly the point there? I mean, what is the
point
of
Well, the point is it would have been worse without NAFTA, yeah. Factories are moving back, yeah.
This is a classical classical argument. It would have been worse without NAFTA. Well, I don't know. I think Mexico was better off economically before NAFTA. We have national industries. My father used to work for national industries that produced tractors, produced even, you know, the trains. They produced many, many things that helped to what we call substitute importations. We didn't need to import everything from the United States. So Mexico had a national industry. That national industry was destroyed by NAFTA and privatization, of course. Not only NAFTA, but privatization of these industries. So to say that we would be worse off without NAFTA, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how Mexico could be worse in the situation of dislocation from the countryside was so devastating that more than 2 million livelihoods or so were lost. This gave way to the massive immigration to the United States. We all know that, but also produced profound social problems. All this dislocation from livelihoods gave way to the big room for the narco trafficking organizations to control Mexico. There are several states in Mexico that are controlled by the narco. Michoacán might be the most strongest example now, in which militias of people have to defend themselves because the government is not capable. And I don't see how Mexico could be worse. No? We have to reverse this process of NAFTA. And this is what President Obama himself said it before during his campaign. Barack Obama said that free trade agreement, globalization, is not good for everybody. It has losers. And this is why we think that we have to reinitiate a process of deglobalization.
Manuel Perez Rocha, again, is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies. And I thank you for joining us. Appreciate your input. And I want to bring more callers into this with Carla Hills and Lori Wallach. We go to Wynn in Menlo Park. Good morning.
Thanks. I think there's been a parallel trend here of importing oil from Canada and Mexico that has displaced the oil that we used to import from the Middle East. So the question is, of the balance of trade problems that we have with Mexico and Canada, what percentage of that now is oil import, which we would have taken from the Middle East anyway?
Ambassador Hills.
Well, the oil imports have declined recently because of our productivity. I think sometimes there's a lag in the statistics, but the economic relationship with Mexico, let me just respond to the prior statement. According to The Economist, Mexico is one of the winners of the NAFTA. Its import competition has improved. The manufacturing productivity is up, and foreign direct investment, not only from the United States, but from around the world, has surged. So I don't see Mexico as being injured by the NAFTA, to the contrary.
Lori Wallach.
The percentage of our trade deficit, and in fact of our trade comprised of oil imports from Mexico and Canada, has actually declined almost 30% since NAFTA. So that huge trade deficit, sometimes people say, oh, it's not really about trade in goods, it's not about offshoring, it's about oil. But the data is actually
contrary. Just like the Mexican government data, you know, lays out that poverty has increased, inequality has increased, wages are flat. The data from the U.S. government shows that oil is actually a declining share of our trade with Mexico and Canada. With Mexico, the big surge in imports, again, a 480% increase in our trade imbalance with Mexico since NAFTA, is manufactured goods. That's the big difference. We are now having things that used to be made here, made in Mexico at lower wages, and then sold here. And the thing that is actually directly NAFTA caused of this, just to answer Ambassador Hill's refrain of you can't blame everything on NAFTA, is actually NAFTA's Chapter 11, the investment rules, has explicit incentives for job offshoring, for moving investment, basically getting rid of a lot of the risks that would have made it questionable about whether you'd have high-end manufacturing relocate to Mexico. You don't have to rely on Mexico's courts. You can go to a foreign tribunal and get government contributions to any lost profits caused by regulatory expenses. You don't have to have any problem with laws being changed. There's a minimum guaranteed locked-in standard of treatment for foreign investors. So these are very direct NAFTA-caused transformation of where production happened in North America. And the wage losses of North American workers, a push downwards towards Mexican wage levels, is precisely what the data of the U.S. government show.
Again, Lori Wallach directs the Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. There's obvious strong disagreement between Ms. Wallach and Ambassador Hills, and probably it's safe to say on where NAFTA should go for the future. But in taking into account where NAFTA should go for the future, or whether it should be renegotiated, or whether it should be rethought out, or whether it should simply be pushed forward to a greater future of globalization and trade agreements, becomes also a central question here. In fact, I'm looking at an email from a listener named Wade who says, and we're getting several like this, trade agreements like NAFTA are negotiated for large money-based interests who always want to move jobs to countries with lower wages, weaker environmental laws, and more lax labor standards. So-called free trade is all about giving more power to the already wealthy and powerful and leaving the rest of us to compete for lower wage jobs. And as I said, there are similar treaties that are being proposed under the Obama administration, Pacific Rim and European trade deals. And I want to go to a caller here. That's Carrie. Carrie, you want to bring up the Trans-Pacific Partnership, yeah?
Right. And what fast-tracking something like that does to democracy, what's the justification for the high level of secrecy in negotiating this and then attempting to fast-track something that is huge through Congress without time for adequate review and giving it just a simple up or down vote? And I think corporations were originally intended to serve us, the human being, and we've flipped that around, and now we are serving artificial entities.
Well, I thank you for the call. Let me go to Ambassador Carla Hills on this, who maybe can point out to listeners what's valuable about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then perhaps respond to what Carrie's bringing up here about the secrecy of the treaty.
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership enables us to work as a region, as a trio of governments, Mexico, Canada, and the United States, to take positions that will advance the unique competitiveness of the North American region. It also gives us the opportunity to move forward on issues that were not on the table when we negotiated the NAFTA. We've had great forward strides with data flows and the like, and we could address those. The comment that was just made is that about consultation. I agree that there should be maximum consultation, particularly with our Congress, but I do not agree that we shouldn't have what I think was referred to as fast track, sometimes called trade promotion authority. I can tell you that when you're sitting opposite another government, and we have a divided government, and we explain that, yes, you can negotiate the agreement, but Congress can take it apart, amend parts of it, and the agreement unravels. The president has constitutional authority to negotiate with foreign governments, and Congress has a constitutional authority to handle the purse strings. So a compact has to be made. to let the president negotiate and let the Congress vote it up or down. If it doesn't like the agreement, then just vote it down. And that enables us to get a much, much better agreement. A foreign party will not put their tough political issues on the table if they think there's a possibility the agreement will not go through or will be amended and unravel. You look at whatever agreement, when we were talking to Mexico, whether it be energy, it's just not possible. You talk to Canada, whether it be their agricultural programs, just not possible unless you have fast-track authority, which we did get, and I strongly recommend that the current administration get it for the important trade agreements that they've undertaken to negotiate.
And Lori Wallach, you, and I think it's fair to say public citizens, are concerned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would not like to see it move forward to fast-track?
Well, it has been the most secretive negotiation ever. Unlike when Ambassador Hills was USTR during NAFTA, and between negotiations, the new text, the draft of the agreement, would be left up in the Congress in a secure reading room for any member of Congress to see. With TPP, up until last summer, even members of Congress weren't even being allowed to see the draft agreement after 4 years of negotiation, which is doubly outrageous. The public's obviously locked out, but Congress has exclusive constitutional authority over trade, not just over the purse strings. Article 1A gives Congress exclusive authority over trade, which gets the fast track. So under the current system, you've got Congress locked out, the public locked out. There's 600 official corporate trade advisors who get to see the text, have an inside role. And now President Obama is basically rolling back on his campaign promise to come up with a more open, democratic way to deal with trade negotiations and the approval of agreements. And instead, he's doubled down and he's back to asking for fast track. Now, fast track was established first by right after Nixon left. It was Nixon's idea. It's only ever been used 16 times. So President Clinton, Mr. Trade Expansion, he implemented 123 trade agreements. Only two of them, NAFTA and WTO, needed fast track. You only need fast track for the trade agreements that basically are about diplomatic legislating. They overreach into setting all these investor offshoring rules, banning Buy American, Buy Local procurement, requiring us to import food that doesn't meet our safety standards, increasing patent durations, et cetera. What Fast Track does is it delegates Congress's constitutional trade authority and legislation writing authority. So a president can sign a trade agreement before Congress votes to approve it and then have a guaranteed 90-day yes or no vote on legislation the White House, not Congress, writes, that Congress does not get to amend in committee, that goes right to the floor for a yes or no vote, no amendments, limited debate.
We're going to have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the hour, but I want to thank both of you, Carla Hills, Chair and CEO of the Hills & Company and primary negotiator for the United States on NAFTA, and Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. We also thank Manuel Suarez-Mir and Manuel Perez Rocha, who also joined us to hear both sides of NAFTA evaluation and assessment 20 years after the fact. We thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Another hour ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.